For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's July the 12th, and we are in Parshas Chukas. We are on page 846. The last thing that happened was that Klal Yisrael tried to go through the land of Edom to get into Eretz Yisrael, and they were denied. So now the Pasuk tells us in Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22, Vayisumi Kadesh, they traveled from Kadesh, Vayavau v'nei Yisrael kol ha'ida hor ha'har. And the entire congregation came to Hor Hahar. Now, Hor Hahar means mountain of the mountain. So Chazal explained there was a smaller mountain atop a larger mountain. It was a small mountain on top of a big mountain. That's why it has the name Hor Hahar, mountain of the mountain. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe ve'al Aaron b'Hor Hahar. So Hashem said to Moshe and Aaron in Hor Hahar, Al Gevul Eretz Edom, on the boundary of the land of Edom, Lemor saying, Ye'asef Aaron Elamov, Aaron will be gathered into his nation, which means he's going to die. Kilo Yavo El Haaretz, for he will not come to the land, Asher Asati Livnei Yisrael, that I gave to the Jewish people. Al Asher Merisem Espila Memeriva, because you rebelled against me. They translated it as you defied my word in Me Meriva with the water. Kach es Aaron ves Elazar beno. Now this is specifically being said to Moshe Rabbeinu. Take Aaron and his son Elazar v'halo sam Hor Hahar and take them up on Hor Hahar. The Jews, when they were encamped at Hor Hahar, doesn't mean they were on top of the mountain. It means they were near the mountain. And now, they're supposed to, Moshe and Aaron and Elazar are supposed to climb the mountain. V'havshetes Aaron es bigadav. Remove from Aaron his clothing. That means the big day kuhuna, the clothing of kuhuna. V'yalbashtam es Elazar beno. And dress them onto Elazar his son. So this will be the official changing of who the Kohen Gadol is. It's going to go from Aaron to his son Elazar. Ve'aaron ye'yasef, Aaron will be gathered in, umeis sham, he will die there. Vayas Moshe kasher tziva Hashem, Moshe divra Hashem told him to do. Vayalu el hor hahar, and they went up on hor hahar. Leinei kol ha'eda, in front of everybody. Everybody saw them go up the mountain. Vayavshet Moshe es Aaron es begadav, Moshe removed from Aaron his clothing. Vayabesh Hashem es Elazar beno, and he dressed them onto Elazar his son. Vayamas Aaron sham berosh ha'har, Aaron died there on top of the mountain. Vayered Moshe ve'Elazar min ha'har, and Moshe and Elazar, they came down from the mountain. So three people went up, two people came down. Vayiru kol ha'ida ki gava Aaron, and the entire nation saw that Aaron had died. Vayivku es Aaron shloshim yom. And they cried for Aaron for 30 days, Kol Beis Yisrael, the entire house of Yisrael. So everybody mourned for Aaron for 30 days. We know that Aaron and Moshe Rabbeinu are not allowed to enter Eretz Yisrael, which means they're going to have to die at some point in the Midbar before entering Eretz Yisrael. Now, we know that Miriam passed away recently, as far as the Chumash is concerned, in the month of Nisan. If you hold the page here, just look back a couple of pages when we talked about Miriam's death. So, back on page 842, it says that they came to Midbar Tzin in Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, Bachodesh HaRishon, in the first month. It was Nisan. And Miriam died. Here, although the Torah does not say right here in Parshas Chukas, when it happens, the Torah does not say the date of Aaron's death, but we know in a few parashios later, actually this coming week's parasha, Parshas Maaseh, when it goes through the travels of the Bnei Yisrael, when it mentions Hor HaHar, it mentions Aaron's death, and the Torah says explicitly that the date of Aaron's death is Rosh Chodesh Av. So Rosh Chodesh Av is the date of Aaron's death. So Miriam passed away in Nisan. We don't know what date in Nisan. We may know, but it's not in the Chumash. It's not, the Chumash doesn't tell us specifically the date of Miriam's death, but it's in Nisan. So Aaron dies on the first day of Av, so it's less than 4 months later. Is it? Let's see. Yer Sivan Tammuz. Yeah. Less than 4 months later is Aaron's death. And that same year, in Adar, the 7th of Adar, is when Moshe Rabbeinu is going to pass away. So Miriam first, then Aaron, then Moshe, all three pass away in the same year. So we know that Aaron is going to have to die before they go into Eretz Yisrael, but it isn't clear when he has to die. And the Torah tells us he dies in this instance here when they get to Hor HaHar. The Torah says in Pasuk Chav Gimel, verse 23, that Hashem speaks to Moshe and Aaron at Hor HaHar, Al Gevul Eretz Edom, on the boundary of the land of Edom. That line seems out of place. Why do you have to tell me that it's on the boundary of the land of Edom? We know that Hor HaHar is in proximity to the land of Edom. They just came from the land of Edom trying to get through, and Edom said no. So we know Hor HaHar is nearby. So why does it have to say on the boundary of the land of Edom? So from here, Chazal tell us, and Rashi cites it, that the reason why Aaron died now again, he's going to die at some point soon, but why does it have to be now? Because the Jews joined together with the Russia, with Esav, with Edom. Because we tried to join together with them, therefore Aaron dies. It's a din that happens to the Bnei Yisrael because of their attempt to be nischaber, to join with Esav. Now, this is a little bit difficult because what did they do wrong? The Jews were at the border of Eretz Yisrael. Their only way in was to go through the land of Edom, or to go all the way around, which is what they end up doing. And they were not allowed to just attack. They needed to ask permission, so they asked permission. So what was wrong with that? What's wrong with them asking permission to go through? So if you recall, in last week's class, we saw that in the back and forth between Bnei Yisrael and Edom, the Jews asked Edom to go through. Edom said no. But then the Jews asked again. There was another back and forth. And again Edom said no. It seems that we were taken to task for continuing the conversation. In other words, the first attempt to go through, that's a reasonable thing to do. It's reasonable to ask Edom, can we go through your land? But when Edom said no, the only way now for Edom to say yes would be that there be some, if it's not through force, would be by some diplomatic means, some sort of a back and forth to convince Edom that it's okay to let us go through. Whenever you deal with somebody diplomatically, which is a good thing typically, but when you deal with it, one country deals with another country diplomatically, what they're looking to do is to minimize their differences and to emphasize their similarities. That's how diplomacy works, is that here we have two countries that are at odds with each other, and whatever it is they're trying to make work between them, whether it is economic issues or agreement over some other type of matter. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to either ignore or de-emphasize, is a better word, to de-emphasize their differences and instead emphasize their mutual gain and benefit from this agreement and how they share certain goals that they can both meet with this agreement. That's what diplomacy really is. And that's how it works. Because even if two countries, and for that matter, two people, share goals and are very similar, But if they emphasize their differences, they're not going to agree to anything. When we emphasize our differences, we have no interest in dealing with each other. So you have to, in order to achieve diplomacy, you have to de-emphasize differences and emphasize similarities. And so in the going back and forth, the give and take between Edom and us meant trying to be somewhat connected with Edom. And that's a problem. Edom is a Rasha. The country is considered to be a country of Rasha'im. They come from Esav. And we are expected to keep our distance and not to try to connect with them, even if the purpose is to get into Eretz Yisrael. So again, the first request to go through, which was simply a request, can we go through your land? It doesn't seem that they were taken to task for that. But then the diplomacy afterwards, when they said no, that was an attempt to connect. And that is where we are taken to task. It is an important thing for us to be aware of, that it is not a simple matter to join together with Rasha'im, with evil people. And you have to define what a Rasha is, of course. You can't just brand people as Rasha'im. Nevertheless, there are Rasha'im in the world, and the one is not supposed to try to join together and emphasize our similarities and de-emphasize our differences with Rasha'im. That's not the way one is supposed to operate. It is important to stay separate from Rasha'im. And that really is why, one of the reasons why we don't run after trying to build bridges between those who really are leading the world down the wrong path. That's not our goal here, is to build bridges. Sometimes we do it pragmatically. Trying to make peace in the Middle East, that's to save people's lives. And that would be a very good thing if that could be pulled off. But at the same time, it's not a goal in and of itself to build bridges with someone who is a bona fide Russia. When I say Russia, I mean a real Russia, not just someone who doesn't know better. I'm talking about someone who's really bent on evil. Then it is not a goal to build a bridge with such a person or with such a country. Now, Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron that Aaron is now going to die. So he tells them the reason why he's not going into the land is because of Mei Meriva, is because of the water. And we know that this is repeated several times in the Chumash, that the reason why Aaron and Moshe Rabbeinu die in the Midbar is because of hitting the rock rather than speaking to the rock. Chazal explained, and Rashi again cites it, that the reason why this is said so many times in the Chumash is so because Moshe Rabbeinu asked that it be written any time their deaths are mentioned. Why? Because most of the Bnei Yisrael died because of the sin of the Meraglim, of the spies, and the sin of the golden calf, of the Egel Hazav. That's the reason why they died. And Moshe Rabbeinu requested that any time that their deaths are mentioned, that the Torah should say the reason why they died in the wilderness, they didn't go into the land, has nothing to do with the Egel Hazav, nor with the Meraglim. But the reason is because they hit the rock. The people shouldn't mistake in their sin for the sin of the rest of the Jewish people. So Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, take Aaron and Elazar and go up the mountain. Now, Elazar is the older of Aaron's two remaining sons. As you know, Aaron really had four sons, but two of them predeceased him. Nadav and Avihu already died back in Parshas Shmini. So now the two who are left, Elazar and Isamar, Elazar is the older of the two, and Elazar is now going to succeed his father as Kohen Gadol. In fact, Elazar is the next Kohen Gadol, and that means he's the second Kohen Gadol in history. The third Kohen Gadol is Elazar's son, Pinchas. He's going to be the third Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol runs in the family until there is reason to switch it. Eventually it does switch to the family of Isamar, and then eventually it switches back to the family of Elazar. Those are stories in and of itself of why it switched back and forth. But the default in the beginning is that it comes from Elazar and from his descendants. And so he takes Aaron and Elazar up the mountain. Aaron has his big day kahuna, his clothing of kahuna on, and Moshe Rabbeinu is instructed to take the clothing off of Aaron and dress Elazar, and then Aaron's going to die. So Chazal tell us that's exactly what happened, that they came up the mountain, and Moshe Rabbeinu, one at a time, took the 8 articles of clothing off of Aaron and dressed Elazar. And then they were in a cave, or Aaron was told to enter a cave, and he entered a cave. There was an area for him to lie down. There was a candle burning in the cave for light. And Moshe Rabbeinu told him to close his eyes and close his mouth, and put down his arms and his feet, and he passed away. He didn't get sick, he just passed away. This is the Misa, the death of Neshika. We mentioned the death of Neshika with Miriam's death. It's not described as in as much detail with Miriam as it is with Aaron, but that's the way Neshika works. Neshika literally means a kiss of Hashem. And as we explained with Miriam, that the process of death is that we are all comprised of 2 parts. We have our physical bodies. We have our spiritual soul. The 2 are melded together in a process that we do not understand, that really defies logic, that the spiritual realm and the physical realm exist in one body. It shouldn't really work. They should reject each other. But that is the way we are created. And death is the process of the separation of the soul and the body. The 2 are pulled apart. The body is put in the ground. The soul goes upstairs. And then Techiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, is the reuniting of the soul with the body. The body is reconstituted. The soul is placed back inside the body. And you have a functioning human being again with 2 parts, with his body and with his Neshama, with his soul. So as we mentioned with Miriam's death, that separating of the soul from the body can either be a very painful process, God forbid, or it can be a much less painful process. It can be quick, it can take a long time, it can be simple, it can be complex. So Neshika is the most painless and most pleasant way a person can pass away. And as we mentioned back with Miriam, that the Chazal compare it to pulling a hair out of a cup of milk. That there's no trauma, there's no friction, you just simply pull the hair out of the milk. The neshama is simply pulled out of the body, just as it was blown into the body by Hashem. It is now pulled out of the body in the same manner. Moshe Rabbeinu here witnesses this death. He's there when it happens to Aaron. And when he sees it happen to Aaron, it says that he's nis'avel osamisa. He desires the same way to die. Because he sees it with Aaron, he sees how it happens, and he wants the same death. So later on, this is going to take a while till we get there, but later, when Moshe Rabbeinu actually does die, so it says, kashames Aaron achicha, the same way your brother Aaron died. That Moshe Rabbeinu dies with Neshika, with the kiss from Hashem, the same way that he saw his brother Aaron die. It is the same process. When Moshe Rabbeinu takes the clothing off of Aaron and places them on Elazar, a nes takes place. And this is also documented in Chazal, that remember that clothing, of course, has outer layers and inner layers. So do the 8 garments of the Kohen Gadol. It has outer garments and it has lower garments that are closer to the body. And as outer garments are removed, that when garments are removed from the body, the outer garments are removed first, the inner garments are removed last. And so, if you're going to take clothing that one person is wearing and put them on another person, what you really should have to do is you should have to remove all the clothing from the one who the clothing is being removed from, and then dress the other person, because you have to get to the lower garments in order to put them on first. So therefore, all the clothing must be removed, and then after all the clothing is removed, then the last article of clothing removed should be the first article of clothing placed on the next person. That's what should happen logically. However, that is not what happened here. Moshe Rabbeinu would take the most outer garment off of Aaron and place that on Elazar. Then he would take the next garment, which would be the second most outer garment, off of Aaron, and he would place that one on Elazar. And a nace would happen, and the second garment would actually go under the first garment. Even though the first garment was dressed on Elazar first, but the next garment, which really belongs underneath the first garment, would somehow go underneath that first garment. And so too that would happen in succession with each of the eight garments, even the last of the eight garments goes all the way against the skin. When Moshe Rabbeinu would put it on Elazar, it miraculously moved and went under the other garments onto his skin directly. That was a nace that took place over here. The Kisav Sofer asks the question, I'm pretty sure it was the Kisav Sofer where I saw this, asks the question, why is this nace necessary? Why have such a nace? It's a beautiful nace. It's a nice miracle. But why is it necessary? Why not just take all the clothing off of Aaron and dress Elazar? Why does it have to be that as you're removing clothing from Aaron, you're placing it on Elazar, which would then necessitate this miracle of the outer garments becoming the inner garments becoming the outer garments? So he explains, because symbolically, Elazar and all future Kohanim Gedolim have to know that they are only Kohanim Gedolim because of their grandfather Aaron. Aaron is the zchus, is the merit through whom all Kohanim are Kohanim, and certainly through whom the Kohen Gadol is the Kohen Gadol. This is also symbolized by the mountain itself, Hor Hahar, which is a small mountain on top of a large mountain. The same idea. All future Kohanim Gedolim are a small mountain on top of the shoulders of the large mountain of Aaron. Aaron was the one who was Zocha, who merited for all future Kohanim the status of Kahuna and the potential of Kohen Gadol. As we have mentioned before, of the leadership of the Bnei Yisrael, there is Malchus, there's royalty, there is Kahuna Gedola, there's the top Kohen, and then there is Torah, being a Talmud Chacham, or the lead Talmud Chacham. As we mentioned before, two of the three of those leadership positions are a family business. The Kahuna Gedola is a family business. Only descendants of Aaron can be the Kohen Gadol. And so too with royalty, only descendants of David HaMelech can be the king. Torah is the only one that's open to anybody. Aaron, when he passes away, it has to be understood that all future Kohanim Gedolim are only standing on his shoulders. He merited it. He's the one who deserved to have the title of Kahuna given to him and to all of his descendants following him. Similarly, to be the Kohen Gadol, he is the first one. Everybody else follows him. The Torah tells us that when Moshe and Elazar came down the mountain, it says all of the congregation saw that Aaron died, and it says in Pasuk Chav Tes, verse 29, "Vayivku es Aaron shloshim yom." They cried for Aaron for 30 days. Kol Beis Yisrael, all of the Jewish people. The emphasis is on the word kol. All of the Jewish people mourned the death of Aaron. If you'll contrast that, let me get the place over here. But if you'll contrast that to the death of Moshe Rabbeinu, if you would like to see it, it's all the way at the end of the Chumash, on page 1122, at the end of Ezos HaBracha, on page 1122, Pasuk Ches, verse 8, it says, Vayivku v'nei Yisrael es Moshe be'arvos Moav shloshim yom. And the Jews cried for Moshe in Arvos Moav for 30 days. It doesn't say Kol Beis Yisrael, all the Jewish people. Rather, just says B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people. Now, obviously, the B'nai Yisrael means all the Jewish people, but there's no emphasis on the word Kol, on the word all. And here, it says all the Jewish people cried for Aaron. So again, Chazal tell us this is because Aaron was beloved to all. People loved Aaron because Aaron was a Matil Shalom. He made peace between people. He was a Rodev Shalom. He was an Ohev Shalom. Aaron HaKohen, he made it his mission to get people to have Shalom with each other. He made it his mission to ensure that people who otherwise were not happy with the other, that they would be, that they would have Shalom, they would have peace. The Chazal tell us in its most basic and simplest form that Aaron would do this by going over to each one and saying, yes, you know, I know your friend that there's, I heard him speaking and he was saying how he has such remorse that he really loves you and doesn't want to have friction with you. And, you know, he would do things like that. And that would serve to break the barriers between the two parties and that they would eventually make Shalom. That's a very simplistic presentation, but it is the basic method that he used. Aaron did it, of course, in a more sophisticated manner, and Aaron did it, it was tailor-made to the two people who were having the fight, but it was what Aaron did, and he made it his business to do so. He also did it between husband and wife, and he brought shalom, he brought peace between people and between husband and wife. And therefore, everybody mourned the loss of Aaron, not just some people, but everybody, Kol Beis Yisrael, all the Jewish people, mourned the loss of Aaron. Pasuk Aleph. Now, so moving on page 848, let's read the next paragraph. Pasuk Aleph, chapter 21, and let's read the next little paragraph here. Vayishma Kenani Melech Arad Yoshev HaNegev. The Kenani, the king of Arad, those who dwelled in the Negev in the south, they heard Ki Ba Yisrael Derech HaAsarim, that the Jews had come on the same route as the spies. If you'll recall last week, we spoke about how the Jewish people were now back where they had been when they sent the spies. So the king of Arad heard that the Jews were now following the same route. Vayilochem be Israel. So the Kenani, the king of Arad, made a war with the Jewish people. Vayishp mimenu shevi, and he managed to take a captive. Chazal tell us literally one captive, one maidservant is all they were able to capture. Klal Yisrael responds, Vayidar Yisrael neder laHashem vayomar, the Jews took an oath to Hashem saying, Im nason titenes amazeh biyodi, if you will give this nation over to my hands, ve'acharabti esareim, I will destroy their cities. Vayishma Hashem b'kol Yisrael, Hashem listened to the voice of the Jewish people, vayitenes haKenani, and he gave over the Kenani to the Jewish people, vayacharim esem esareihem, so the Jews destroyed them and their cities. Vayikrashem amakom Charma, and the name of the place was called Charma. So we have an incident here of a war. It seems like a minor war, but a war nonetheless, where the Jews were attacked and they davened and they successfully win the war. why were they attacked at this time, and who is this person, this nation that attacks them? So if you go back to the last pasuk, the last verse of the previous paragraph, pasuk Chavtes, verse 29, the pasuk there says, Vayiru kol ha'idah ki gava Aaron. And the whole congregation saw that Aaron had died. There's another way to read this pasuk, and that is, rather, we're going to change the vowels a little bit. Instead of Vayiru kol ha'idah, instead of the entire congregation saw, rather, Vayeira'u kol ha'idah. Rather, the entire nation was seen. Ki gava Aaron, instead of that Aaron died, we're going to translate it as on account of or because Aaron died. The word ki is a versatile word which can mean several things. It can mean that, but it can also mean because of. So the first way to read the pasuk is, and all the congregation saw that Aaron died. But the second way to read it is, all the congregation was seen because Aaron died. So what does that mean? So from here we derive that the clouds, the Aaronic Kavod, disappeared with Aaron's death. They disappeared. And that because of that, the Jews were now visible. They were now seen, because until now the clouds covered us and you couldn't see us. But now the Jews suddenly were visible because of Aaron's death. Just like with Miriam, we learned that the way we know that the Be'er, that the well, was on account of Miriam is because the water disappeared when Miriam died. Here as well, we know the clouds were in the merit of Aaron because the clouds disappeared when Aaron died. In both cases, they're going to come back. The water comes back, as we had before, in the merit of Moshe and Aaron. And here also, the clouds will come back in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. But at this point, the clouds have disappeared. Therefore, the king of Arad sees an opportunity to attack the Jewish people because the clouds are no longer there, and he thinks that this means that now from heaven, it is permitted to attack the Jewish people. Chazal tell us this king of Arad, that's allegedly a Kenani, is not a Kenani at all, but rather this king of Arad is Amalek. And it is the people of Amalek attacking the Jewish people for a second time. The first time Amalek attacked the Jewish people was also around the discussion of water. That was at the end of Parashas Beshalach, after Moshe Rabbeinu was told to hit the rock, and did hit the rock, and the water came forth. Then Amalek attacked the Bnei Yisrael. Here as well, when he was told to speak to the rock, and he hit the rock instead. Shortly thereafter, Amalek attacks the Bnei Yisrael. So Amalek attacks over here. Why is Amalek referred to? First of all, how do we know it's Amalek? Because it says Yoshev HaNegev, those who dwell in the south. Amalek historically lived south of Eretz Yisrael. Why are they called Kenani? So Chazal tell us the reason is because the Amalekim knew that the Jewish people have the capacity to daven, and that Hashem will save us. So therefore, they needed to have some sort of a ruse that would prevent the Jews from davening appropriately. So what they came up with is, we're going to trick the Jewish people. We are going to speak in the language of the Kenanim, not in the language of the Amalekim. So we're going to speak Kenani language, in order to trick the Jewish people into thinking that we are Kenanim. What's the point of tricking the Jewish people? Because if they believe that we're Kenanim, and they don't know that we are really Amalekim, they will daven that Hashem should deliver them from Kenanim. But we're not Kenanim. And therefore, their tefillah will go unheeded, it will be an incorrect tefillah, and we will win. So the Jews saw this nation that was speaking the language of the Canaanim. But they were wearing the clothing of the Amalekim. Even though they disguised their voices, they did not disguise their clothing. The clothing was Amaleki clothing. So the Jewish people scratched their heads and said, well, are these people Canaanim, as their language implies, or are they Amalekim, as their clothing implies? We don't know. Therefore, they davened without specifying. They left out the name. They just said, if you give over this nation to us, then we will destroy their cities. And Hashem listened to their tefillah. That is the way Chazal depict this incident, and it's the second clash with Amalek that is recorded in the Chumash. So this, of course, requires a lot of explanation. First of all, if the Amalekim were going to try to trick the Jewish people into davening for the wrong nation, how is it that they didn't change their clothing? Isn't that the first thing you do when you're trying to create a disguise, is you change your clothing? But they didn't do that. All they did was change their language. They didn't change their clothing. So why not? Why didn't they change their clothing? Wouldn't the Jews then have really been confused? And then their plot would have worked. Amalek's plot would have worked. And the Jews would have davened for the wrong nation. That's one. Two is that, why is it that the davening needs to be specific? After all, it wasn't specific in this case. The Jews decided not to daven specifically, and they were answered. So then, why do we ever daven specifically? Why not just daven generally, which is what the Jews did over here, and it worked, and they won the war. So let's always daven that way. Why daven specifically, and then run the risk of having the wrong thing in mind? Now, regarding the first question of why the Amalekim did not change their clothing, you should know that there is a machlokas about this. It's a medrash, and there is a machlokas how to understand it, whether the Amalekim only changed their language but not their clothing, as Rashi says, or if in reality they actually changed both their clothing and their language. So if we are to learn that they changed both their clothing and their language, then this question would not be a question. Our question is based on Rashi's version, which is they changed only their language, not their clothing, and that's actually how they were discovered by the Jewish people, because their clothing had not changed. So then we have our question, why didn't they change their clothing? So a possible answer to this, and later I saw that the Shari Aaron offers this answer as well. And the possible answer to this is that if they would have changed their clothing as well as their language, then they really would have been Canaanim. What do I mean by that? They're not Canaanim, they're Amalekim. By blood, they were born as Amalekim. They weren't born Canaanim. And as much as they might want to identify as Canaanim, that doesn't work. So how is it that they become Canaanim if they change their clothing? And the answer is because when a person completely transforms themselves and they speak like a different nationality, and they dress like a different nationality, in many ways, they actually take on the characteristics of that nationality. We've talked about this before, how clothing is very powerful. When you wear certain clothing, you behave in a certain way. When you dress casually, you behave casually. When you dress in a more formal manner, then you behave in a more formal way. It's the nature of a human being that we are affected by what we wear. And therefore, when we talk about proper dress for, let's say, attending shul, so Of course, we have to deal with modesty as an important factor. That's, of course, that goes without saying. But it's not just modesty. It's also formality. That formal dress puts us in the right mindset to daven properly. Casual dress, then we daven more casually. That's the nature of the beast. This is also why it's important for a person to change their clothing for Shabbos. That a person has weekday clothing and Shabbos clothing. It's not just that, it's a good excuse to wear something nice. There is a positive concept and mention in the Gemara to change one's clothing for Shabbos. Because when we're dressed for Shabbos, then we act in a Shabbos manner. If a person is not dressed for Shabbos, it's very difficult to act in a Shabbos manner. I'm not necessarily talking about forgetting that it's Shabbos, although that could happen. I'm not talking about, by accident putting on the lights because you can't remember that it's Shabbos because you're not dressed for Shabbos, although that could happen. But that's not what I'm referring to specifically. I'm really referring to just having a Shabbos mindset, being in the mode of thinking and feeling Shabbos. That happens very much because of the way we are dressed. And when one dresses in a non-Shabbos way, it's more difficult to think and feel Shabbos. If the Amalekim would have not only changed their language, but also changed their clothing to Kenani, then they really would have begun to mimic the real behaviors of the Kenanim. And it wouldn't have just been on the surface. It really would have been more internal. And it is therefore difficult to act as Amalekim anymore. They would act as Kenanim. If that would be the case, then the Jews davening that Hashem should have them defeat the Kenanim actually would have worked for the Amalekim. Because the Amalekim, in a certain way, would have actually been Kenanim. And therefore, the tefillah would have worked. So therefore, the Amalekim didn't want to be fully like the Kenanim. They wanted to be enough like the Kenanim to fool the Jewish people, or at least to confuse the Jewish people. And, but in the end, what the Jews did is they just made their davening very general, and that's how they won. Now, why does their davening need to be specific? The implication over here is that it is better if a davening is specific. That is better. But in this case, they couldn't do that, so they made it general. And that is the case. What we learn is that when one davens, it is best for one to make their davening as specific as possible. Now, we don't have the ability of changing the language of the Shmona Esrei. The Shmona Esrei comes from the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, and because that body of Torah scholars was made up of great, great, great people, and among them prophets, Nevi'im, therefore we don't have the shoulders to start playing with that language. We're going to keep exactly what they wrote and say it exactly as they said it. However, there are parts of davening where one has the ability to say their own thing, like at the end of Shmona Esrei, one can do that. And in those parts of davening, it is best to be specific rather than general. A specific tefillah is usually a more powerful tefillah. A more general tefillah is usually a less powerful tefillah. And that is learned from here. Because we see over here that the Jews really were expecting to daven specifically, and when they couldn't, then they were forced to daven generally. And even though over in this case it did work, Baruch Hashem, they were able to win the war even though they were davening generally instead of specifically, but it is still best to daven specifically in those cases that it is warranted. The regular Shmona Esrei that we daven, it is not warranted to change the wording, but for the areas where we can be specific, then we should be specific. Yes, Mrs. Deitch.
So what's the reason for that? Why? Because I would think that it's better because we don't really know what's good, or we don't really know the specifics. And so why is it better to be specific when I understand that we are saying it's from you, Hashem. But why is it better that the tefillah has to be specific and fight this nation? Why not, like, fight the nation that's fighting us? Why does it have to be Amalek or Canaan? What's the difference? Why?
Yeah, so your example where we don't know what's best, so then we make it general. So in that case, we should be general, because we don't know what's best. Like over here, where they didn't know what the nation was, in a case where you don't know what you want or what you need, then one should speak generally and not specifically. That's correct. And we do learn from there that is the way to go when we don't know. So a person is faced with a difficult situation in their lives, and they don't know what's best for them. They don't know if it's better that it be this way or that way. So then we often resort to saying, Hashem, please do what's best for me, which is a reasonable thing to do when we don't know. However, a davening is going to be more, there's going to be more of a person is going to put themselves more into a davening that is specific. If you think about it for a moment, let's say a person is under financial stress. Let's use that example. So a person feels that they would like to be able to take care, to pay their bills, and to be able to handle their finances better. So they daven to Hashem for financial relief. So it's true that to daven that I should be financially successful this specific way, so there's no reason to do that. Why should I be specific in that way? I don't know. Hashem has many ways of giving me financial relief. It doesn't have to be the way that I think it should be. So there's no reason to daven and say, Hashem, make my business successful. I can say, Hashem, give me financial relief. So that is general. However, we don't say to a person that you shouldn't daven for financial relief. Instead, what you should do is, you should say, Hashem, whatever's best for me should happen. If it's better off that I have financial stress, I should have financial stress, and if not, I should have financial relief. That's not what we tell a person. We tell a person, you should daven for financial relief. Because we as human beings, we feel we have needs, and we have pain, and we have suffering, and our davening is always to alleviate that. If Hashem deems it best that we unfortunately need to go through a certain amount of suffering, so okay, He'll do that. But that's not the way davening works. Davening is meant to be something which we emotionally throw ourselves into. And the emotion is that Hashem should take care of us. And if we feel a lack or a pain or something like that, then we ask that it be removed. So the more specific it is, then the more likely or the easier it is for a person to throw themselves into it emotionally. And the more general it is, it becomes more of a detached sort of thing. And that's not the way davening is supposed to be. Davening is supposed to be something that is emotional and something that we throw ourselves into. So I imagine that has a lot to do with it. There's probably more to this, but I imagine that's part of the answer.
And also, why in Pasuk Gimel does it say "Vayitena Saknani"?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's the reason for that?
Because the way it started was calling them Kenani. It said, the Torah never calls them Amalekim. It's only the Gemara that says that. The Medrash says that they were Amalekim. But the Torah from the beginning calls them Kenanim. So, the Torah is not, they are in disguise. There is a disguise going on over here. It may not be a foolproof disguise, but it is a disguise.
Okay, thank you.
There actually is a machlokus in the Gemara. There is another opinion that says it wasn't Amalekim, but this is the main opinion, that it was the Amalekim, and that's the one that Rashi brings over here. Now, with this, the the Jewish people seem to have now emerged from this episode in good shape. So they lost Aaron, obviously that's terrible, and they aren't able to go through Edom, and then they get attacked by Amalek, but they daven and they win the war. So good. So you would expect that at this point the Jewish people should feel good. They should feel like, okay, we went through a rough time, but we see Hashem is with us. We're ready to move forward. But in fact, the Jews here have a very difficult time. Now, the next paragraph, which is what we're going to lead off with next week, which starts with Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, is going to discuss a difficulty that we have, and it's going to lead to trouble. But there's also another episode that takes place here that is not written in the Chumash. Rashi mentions it in at least three different places, including in Parshas Pinchas and in Parshas, as they mentioned in Masei. He mentions it in a few places in the Chumash, and we're going to discuss it as well next week. So when we pick it up next week, Mitzvah Hashem, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about an episode that happens between the two paragraphs that we're up to right now, between Pasuk Gimel and Pasuk Dalet, between verse 3 and verse 4, there's an unwritten story that takes place, which is a difficult story, and then we move on to the next paragraph as well, which we'll also have an episode we'll have to cover. Any other questions? Okay.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.